Now, going on to chapter 4 of the Holiness of God. This chapter is entitled The Trauma of Holiness. The Trauma of Holiness. And you'll see that we're going to cover 5 headings here. We're looking at the sea calmer, the fish catcher, the curve breaker, and the trouble maker. And so we shall begin with the sea calmer. Dr. Sproul begins with the miracle of Jesus calming the waters on the lake. And those of you who have been to the Holy Land know these storms can whirl up very rapidly and unexpectedly, just in a matter of seconds. And that's what happened when one of these storms whirled up while they're crossing this lake. And the disciples get very angry and very annoyed at Jesus. Why? Because in the midst of this storm that's threatening their lives, he's sleeping. So they went to wake him up. And yet at times you wonder why, because it looks as if they didn't expect really much from him. Certainly not what he went on to do. Dr. Sproul says of this calming of the waters, Jesus controlled the fierce forces of nature by the sound of his voice. He didn't say a prayer. He didn't ask the Father to deliver them from the tempest. He dealt with the situation directly. And this is where I think this chapter's key point comes out. He says, we see a strange pattern unfolding here. Now that the sea was calm, the fear of the disciples increased. Rather unexpected. You think, calm, sea, calm, soul. But no, they are the more afraid. So Dr. Sproul refers here to Sigmund Freud's theory of why people invent a God. He said people invent religion out of a fear of nature, so that they can have a God who is more powerful than all the forces of nature, and especially the disasters of nature. In other words, that they can have a God to help them with scary things. So people see the power of nature, they see volcanoes and earthquakes, they see disease. They think, we need somebody bigger than this to control this, and then they kind of project out, therefore, a bigger God in order to make them feel safer. And yet, as Dr. Sproul says here, in the power of Christ, they met something that they had never met in nature. They were in the presence of the Holy. And so he asks, why would the disciples invent a God whose holiness was more terrifying than the forces of nature that provoked them to invent a God in the first place? So he's saying, okay, let's just take this as a given that here are these forces of nature, and the disciples invent a God that's bigger than these forces of nature in order to relieve them of fear, and yet it produces more fear. How does Freud's theory stand up to that? When the disciples see what Christ was capable of, they ask this question, what manner of man is this? And this is really something very intuitive to human beings. When we see something, we want a box for it. We want a category. Whoever it is or whatever it is, we want to put it in some list, some category that makes us feel, oh, I'm familiar with that. That's something I can live with. But here, what manner, what kind of man is this? They didn't have a category. They couldn't find a box. He didn't go on any of the lists that they were familiar with. As Dr. Sproul says, the disciples could find no category adequate to capture the person of Jesus. He was beyond typecasting, sui generis, literally a class by himself. He's in his own category. He's on his own list. He's in his own box, if we can say that. He's one of a kind. And in that sense, foreign. Jesus was different, he says. He possessed an awesome otherness. He was the supreme mysterious stranger. He made people uncomfortable. So I think you can see where Dr. Sproul's going here. He's, in the last couple of chapters, been talking about God in general as holy, but now he's coming to the Lord Jesus Christ. And then beginning to see how equally holy and awesome and other he is. Then he goes on to a second miracle, which we'll look at under the heading of the fish catcher. Again, a miracle that we're all familiar with. Disciples have fished all night. They come in. Jesus tells them, cast the nets on the other side. This frustrated them to some degree. They saw this as their area of expertise. Who was this teacher to try and teach them? But yet when they did it, as Sproul says, it was as if the fish were having a contest to see who could jump in first. And again, the reaction. This miracle created tremendous discomfort, especially in Peter, as Luke 5:8 makes clear, "Depart from me, for I am a sinful man, O Lord." So here's this man, he's seen this miracle, again this control over nature, and it makes him incredibly, desperately uncomfortable, so uncomfortable that he says, "Get away from me." There were really two steps to this. Initially, he falls before Jesus in worship. And then secondly, he says, "Go away from me, for I am a sinful man." This was why he wanted Jesus away. It's because I am sinful. Now, Jesus had spoken before about sin to Peter and about Peter's sin to Peter. But here, something different happened. Peter didn't just learn his sinfulness with the head, but with his whole soul, so that he was not just uncomfortable, but really, like Isaiah, undone. Dr. Sproul says, "Misery loves company, and thieves do not seek the consoling presence of the fellowship of police officers. Sinful misery does not love the company of purity." When the holiness of Christ appeared, Peter felt, "Let me out of here." And this, of course, is in contrast to many human reactions to Jesus. When you look even at atheists and people who have been tremendous opponents of Christianity, Jesus even can have a good reputation with them to some degree. Friedrich Nietzsche, the philosopher, spoke of Jesus as a model of the heroic. This was a total nihilist. George Bernard Shaw, again, tremendous opponent of Christianity, said he could think of no higher standard than Christ. In fact, he said this awful statement, "There were times when he did not behave as a Christian." Meaning he's looking at Christians and seeing how they behave, and then he sees Christ and says, "He doesn't behave like them." Even Pontius Pilate could find no fault in him. So, why was he killed? If all his contemporaries seemed to accept him at times, and even to this day, tremendous opponents of Christ applaud him, why was he ultimately killed? That's a big puzzle, isn't it? And Dr. Sproul's answer is this: people can have an appreciation for moral excellence as long as it's a safe distance from them. You remember Jesus himself spoke to the people of his own day. He said, you take the prophets, you praise them, you paint their tombs white, but the prophets of this day you're killing, especially himself. And again, he's saying, yeah, you can praise those who were holy in the past and are distant from you chronologically, but when holiness is present in the present, you want to destroy it. The Jews honored the prophets from a distance. The world honors Christ from a distance. But not when you're up close, personal, with the holiness of Christ. And then Dr. Sproul goes on to illustrate this with what he calls the curve breaker. And he looks first of all at the Peter principle, which is that people tend to rise to their level of incompetence in an organization or in a company. In other words, there's somebody doing well, so he's promoted, and then he does well, so he's promoted, and then he gets promoted eventually so high that it's beyond his actual competence and abilities, but he's stuck there now. And he's in a job that he has no ability for. And I'm sure we've all known people like that. Maybe we've been in that position. So everyone ends up being promoted to the job they cannot do. They're promoted to their level of incompetence. But he said there are two types of people this doesn't apply to. The super incompetent, they don't get promoted at all. And the super competent. Why do they not get promoted? Well, it's because people are afraid of them. The boss looks at the super competent employee and says, well, I'm not promoting him because he'll become a threat to me and maybe take my next position. And so the super competent tend to get on in life by moving companies rather than moving within a company. Why is this? It's again because of envy. You might have a boss who would praise such an employee. In general, oh, it would be wonderful to have an employee who would be like this, this, and this. But then when he has such an employee, feels threatened by him and keeps him down. Again, when it's close and personal, it's opposed and destroyed. And it gives the example of grading on a curve so that maybe an exam is set and you've got maybe a 10 kids and, well, they all seem to have, you know, B's and C's. We need some A's, so we need to curve the grades up a bit. Which is great until you get a curve breaker, where there's somebody who gets the A, who gets 100 in the test that everybody else is flunking and sort of disproves the theory that the test was over hard. How popular is the curve breaker going to be? Not very popular. And he tells a story about this student, a 4.0 student, who was flying through all her exams and then came to one exam and totally flunked it. And Sproul called her in and said, well, what's happened? She was in tears. And she said, I just want to be like everyone else because everyone else hates me because I make them look bad. And she was worried about not getting married because everyone thought she was too smart for them. Nobody likes curve breakers. They make us all look bad. And having given these illustrations, Dr. Sproul returns to Jesus and says, he was the super competent. He was the curve breaker that made everyone else look bad. So the Pharisees, they had majors in holiness. They were the holy ones. So were the Sadducees. They could have spoken and preached and talked about holiness all day long. And people thought they were holy also. But what happened when the holy Jesus appeared? They hated him and tried to kill him. Why? Because he was authentically holy. And they were only counterfeiters. They looked holy and righteous until Jesus appeared and made them look and feel unholy and unrighteous. Had Jesus said nothing to them, says Dr. Sproul, they still would have despised him. His mere presence was enough to cause them to recoil from them. He says, every counterfeiter fears that someone will examine his bogus bill while holding a genuine one next to it. The supercompetent had to be destroyed. The curve breaker had to be destroyed. That brings us on to point four, the troublemaker. There's that passage in the book where a Dutch expression is referred to. I'm not going to try and say it. Maybe Tom, do you know the expression? A minister walked by, met her. Oh, really? Okay. So he tells this story about, you know, when Dutch people are in this group and there's suddenly an awkward silence. They say this Dutch phrase, "Oh, a minister must have walked by," and the sense again is, "Oh, somebody holy appeared and, you know, made everyone else quiet." And then he tells these stories about himself golfing with people, Billy Graham golfing with people, and again they've said nothing about religion, and yet the people were just so mad with them and angry. Just because they felt convicted, condemned, even by the very presence of someone more holy than they. And then he uses this illustration of mice and men, and I'll come back to that in the question time. But he closes with this passage about tolerating Jesus. The world could tolerate Jesus, they could love him, but only at a distance. Christ is safe for us if securely bound by space and time, but a present Christ could not survive in a world of hostile men. It was the judgment of Caiaphas that for the good of the nation, he must die. So that by way of summary, I want to leave you with two questions, and the first one is this: should we fear Jesus more? You might say, well, should we fear Jesus at all? Should we fear Jesus more? Well, let's go back to that passage about Freud. These miracles tend to disprove this theory, because when Christ exercised supernatural power, they feared more than when they did in the face of natural power. They feared exceedingly after nature was conquered, more than before when they were defeated by nature. So, Sproul asks that question: why would the disciples invent a God whose holiness was more terrifying than the forces of nature that threatened them? And so I come back to my question. Here are the disciples. Nature makes them afraid. Supernature comes in and makes them even more afraid. Nature makes them this level of fear. Jesus gives them a higher level of fear. Should therefore we fear Jesus more than we do? I can hear you answering, of course not. Jesus is the friend of sinners. He's bone of our bone and flesh of our flesh. He's one of us, one with us, one like us. He is tender, loving, kind. No, that's true. And we must hold on to that tenaciously. The humanity of Christ is the greatest comfort of my life, and I hope a constant theme of my ministry. But he's not only like us, he's also unlike us. And that's often forgotten today. What manner of man is this? It's a different kind of man in many ways. They thought he was just like them, and he was, but now in another sense they realize he's unlike them. So don't we need more of this today? In our preaching, in our churches, in our personal lives? Again, not by reducing the welcoming humanity of Christ. That's what draws us to Him with such great love. But mustn't we also add a far greater emphasis on the awesome deity of Christ? And that's what makes us cautious in approaching Him with irreverence. So, really, this passage would indicate that the more we know Him, the more we encounter Him, the closer we get to Him, we both feel more comforted and more reverent. At least from time to time, surely we should know something of what the disciples experienced on these Galilean waters. And if not, again, it makes us ask the question, are we maybe inventing a Christ of our own imagination? That's one question. Should we fear Jesus more? Second question, why do people hate Christians so much? You ever wondered that? You look around us today especially, you see this unprecedented level of hatred and hostility towards Christians, and we find ourselves asking, well, why? Why do you hate us so much? Politicians, judges, educators, producers, writers, many more, they're very sympathetic and tolerant of every kind of false religion and every kind of perversity, except when it comes to Christian teaching and values. Then the sharp knives come out. And you, again, you're like, well, why? Why do you hate us so much? We pay our taxes. We pray for our leaders. We give generously to charities more than anyone else. We volunteer in local schools and community projects. We love and educate our children. We feed the homeless. We send millions of dollars and thousands of people abroad to needy countries and nations. We make many other positive contributions to the society and the world. So why do you keep lining up against us? And lining up with those who do the exact opposite. Who do nothing for society or for the needy. You love the new atheists. You love atheistic philosophers and authors and comedians who launch vile diatribes against Christians and their gods. And why don't we ask Stephen Fry, I'm sure some of you saw that horrendous, blasphemous attack by the English comedian on God. Why don't we ask him, what have you ever done to eradicate the diseases that you protest about so much? How much money have you ever contributed to children's health? You who have devoted your lives to destroying Christians and their God, what have you ever done constructively? What have you ever done for the poor? How much time and money do you devote to your neighbours, your community, the poor at home and abroad? And yet it's us you hate. Why? Well, I think this chapter gives the best explanation for it. This seemingly irrational enmity, I think, is explained by the Peter principle and the curve breaker, by what we see in these lakes of Galilee. Of course, this was speaking about Jesus, the ultra-competent, the ultimate curve-breaker. But, of course, wherever holiness appears, even imperfectly in God's people, the same response can be expected. Insofar as we reflect the holiness and the righteous standards of God, we can expect the same hostility for the same reasons. It may seem irrational, but it's really very rational. They're saying basically, your virtue makes us look bad and feel guilty. So you must be damaged and destroyed. It's as simple as that. The world far prefers to be surrounded with homosexuals, polygamists, criminals, and every kind of false religionist under the sun than to spend a minute with a holy Christian. The former make them feel good about themselves. The Christian makes them feel guilty. The Christian must go. That's why we are hated. And that's why we will be even more hated in the future.